Welcome to the Gold Standard Turkey Week edition here on the 440 Sports Network. My name is Braden Gall. You can follow me on Twitter at Braden Gall.
Who are you calling a turkey?
Not you, sir. You are my wonderful, intelligent, thoughtful, articulate co-host on the Gold Standard and of course, from The Athletic.
Now you're overselling it. That was way too many adjectives. And I'm Adam Vingan at Adam Vingan.
And pay for good journalism, of course. Make sure you go into The Athletic. Subscribe to all the good stuff they've got there. You can pick and choose all your favorite teams, including, of course, the Nashville Predators. Rate, review, and subscribe to this podcast, please, as well. And not a whole lot of news in the NHL world. We're on the dead of the offseason here. So we thought we'd have a little fun, inspired by what took place over the weekend on social media in Nashville, which is an argument about tagging players. So we thought we would get into, Adam, some fun discussion, storytelling from the beat, if you will. Life inside the Predators locker room. You, of course, has been inside that locker room for what? How many years now?
Almost six.
Almost 6 years. So this is war stories from the Nashville Predators beat, if as it were.
A lot of social media ombudsmen in this market, I feel like.
You mean like dictators that have rules and regulations?
Perhaps, but I always find it interesting when these sorts of journalism, ethics, / protocol conversations happen on social media, which we will now get into.
Yeah, so let's start with that. And we'll get into things like, you know, I worked on the player show, how that was different than the role of hosting a morning show, talking about the Preds every morning. A couple of Peter Laviolette stories for everybody out there as well. Just sort of being in the locker room and around players. And some of that does come from the you know, what's life going to be like on the beat for you during a pandemic, both last year and coming up this year? Having to, you know, you're probably, God, when are you going to be back in the locker room? We don't know. So a conversation started over the weekend on social media about tagging players in your tweets as a reporter. And I thought this was a good way for us to kick off a show during a holiday week about what are sort of the appropriate things to do as it pertains to covering a team.
Was it Joe Rexroad that started it?
I actually don't know, have any clue how this started. But I think it was Paul Kaharsky and Joe Rexroad.
They were the principals in the conversation, but then it, of course, everybody jumped in.
Well, and as now a self-ordained local judge, jury, and executioner on all things media, as yes, host of the Lamestream Sports Media podcast, I, of course, needed to jump in and settle the debate. And, of course, you can listen to more of this conversation on Lamestream Sports this week, actually. But you chimed in as well, and I think part of the reason I wanted to bring it up with you is because I think you have it pretty much spot on, so we're going to agree on this.
Okay.
But basically the question is, should you be tagging players? Like if we're watching a Preds game and we're covering the Nashville Predators and Ryan Ellis has a really bad penalty kill.
Bad example, Ryan Ellis doesn't have any social media.
Okay, fair point. Ryan Johansson.
He does have social media.
Has a really bad penalty kill. And you go on, you're writing your story, you're getting ready to do whatever it is you're doing. And in a tweet, you say, man, really bad minute and a half, you know, penalty kill from Ryan Johansson, missed a few assignments, you know, bad exit pass from the zone, you know, whatever, whatever it could be.
Yes.
What is the ethical line on tagging a player in that tweet? And you had an interesting response.
I never tag players. Now, I can't say definitively that I have never tagged a player, but My rule is I never tag players because most athletes name search. We all name search, but athletes name search too. So my rule is that, well, it's not really a rule. It's more of a guiding principle that if an athlete is going to seek out something about them, they're going to find it whether or not you tag them in it. So I don't think it's an act of cowardice, for example, to criticize a player and not put his Twitter handle in it, because you know they either follow you on social media, and or follow your work. A lot of athletes claim not to read what's written about them. I think that's largely BS.
I also think it's human nature to want to read what's written about you.
Exactly. So for me, I think my only exception is if you are writing something positive. Let me give you an example. In early 2019, I think it was January 2019, you might remember this story coming out. Well, first it came out via video of P.K. Subban. It was like a 45-second video of P.K. Subban speaking to a young boy named Ty Cornett, who was a teenage black hockey player in the Detroit area who had been the subject of racism, or object of racism, either or. And I wrote a story speaking to the young boy's father about his experience and what that video from PK meant to him. Now, I think when I tweeted out the article once, I included PK Subban's Twitter handle so that he might come across it, or someone on his social media team might come across it, and they retweet it, and therefore I get more views and subscriptions. So it was more selfish.
Which is mostly...
It was self-serving.
The only time I ever do it is when I'm sort of acting less as a media member and more as a fan. And if you know, Roman Yossi wins the Norris Trophy, I might tag him in that and say, hey, congratulations, Nashville Predator finally wins the Norris Trophy. Congratulations on a great season to Roman Yossi. And in that role, I'm not really acting as a media member. That's just sort of right. Me as a fan saying that. Or frankly, with the Preds, and this is very easy to do with the Preds because they do so much good work in the community.
Right.
If they've partnered with Mend or something and I want to call that out as a positive thing, I would tag, hey, great work by at Preds NHL and at Mend or what, you know what I mean? Like generally I'm doing it more as a personal thing. I'm doing it as a fan or a Nashvillian.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise I'm a never tagger. I don't tag anybody in any tweet.
No, I am a never tagger. And what I find interesting, and this may segue into our next topic of conversation, is oftentimes if you write something negative or tweet something negative, fans who disagree with you, typically those who in this case will wear gold-tinted glasses, let's say, will say, oh, you would never have the fortitude to say that to them in person.
I always love that.
As if I'm not in the dressing room every single day. I'm very easily accessible to these players. But I do not tag. My rule of thumb, like I said, is if they want to find it, they will find it. They either someone will point it out to them or they will name search and find it themselves. In my personal opinion, I feel no obligation to tag a player in anything I've tweeted about them or written about them.
And I do understand the argument for the tagging, which is to say, you know what, I in an effort to create transparency, I want to make sure that you know overtly that I'm saying this about you. And your argument, which I tend to agree with, which is that if you're around these guys enough and you have a relationship with them and you've written something critical about them or say something critical about them, there's a really good chance you're going to have a conversation about it at some point in the future.
Or before the story is written.
Which is really the professional
there
way
there is time, and it's not so much saying to a player, hey, I'm going to write this story that is critical of this or of you. But players are smart enough to know that if you go up to them and are asking them questions about why they're not playing well or whatever, they're smart enough to know that something down the line is coming that's probably not flattering. But one of my rules is that if possible, I mean, it's different now. We'll talk about life in, you know, covering a beat since the coronavirus, you know, consumed us. But one of my guiding principles, to use that phrase again, is if I am going to write a story that is going to be critical of somebody, that person's voice has to be in the story.
Or at least be given the opportunity
to be
in the story.
Yes, they can, of course, decline. Right. But if I'm going to write a story critical of Victor Arvidsson, for example, like Victor Arvidsson...
Why would you ever do that?
Victor Arvidsson is going to be in the story. He will have a chance to, quote-unquote, defend himself. You know, and that happens beforehand, obviously, because I have to ask the questions before I write the story.
Right.
So that's one thing I always say, is that the player, if it's specifically about a player or a coach, that person will have the opportunity to respond to questions about it before the story is written.
I think that's totally fair. I am curious what the rules of engagement are for radio hosts, for example, because I never really wanted to be friends with people. I didn't want to get into the locker room and be friends with people because I had to be more critical more often,
but
I guess.
You can be in the dressing room and not be friends
with
the players.
No, you're absolutely right. And our bosses at my old job would be like, why aren't you down there? Why aren't you down there? Get down there more. And there was a million reasons why I couldn't. First of all, I just didn't think morning skate was all that informative, but we'll get to that in a second. I always felt like I didn't need to go talk to Peter Laviolette in the locker room because I was going to interview him in real time on the air.
Mm-hmm.
So I knew I was going to be able to talk to all of the coaches in real time in front of everybody. And so if I was ever critical about, let's say, the power play, it was very easy for me to ask Peter Laviolette a question about the power play and say, hey, you know, we've been critical about the power play, coach. What are your plans to fix it now that you've moved so-and-so coach over here or whatever? So I always viewed the opportunity because, you know, I was fortunate enough to have that role where I could speak to Peter Laviolette or Dan Muse or Kevin McCarthy or whatever and had 15 minutes of one-on-one time with them every week on Wednesday mornings. We had a chance to talk to them. And so I just didn't view it as that important for me to go to the press conference on Monday when I knew I was going to talk to them on Wednesday and get his answer in real time for the entire audience, I guess.
You had a unique opportunity in that light. Not all radio hosts have that opportunity. And it depends. A player's media consumption, of course, depends on the player. Like, there are players in the dressing room that are either currently here or were once here who don't, you know, pardon my French, don't give a shit. Like, their job is to play hockey, and they don't care what you think. Of course, they're professional. I'm not. I didn't play. So they what I say about their performance is irrelevant to them. There are others,
it's probably
though,
a smart way to go about
no,
it.
No, it is. There, we could all benefit from that point of view. There are others, though, that do consume it in a variety of ways. I mean, here's an example that predates my time in Nashville. That's not about me, but I witnessed it, and I found it to be interesting. So maybe it was 2012, 2013. I can't remember the exact year. I was still covering the Washington Capitals. And my colleague, who worked for Comcast Sportsnet Washington, Chuck Gormley, who is a veteran journalist. He's retired now. He's a veteran journalist, covered the Philadelphia Flyers for a very long time before moving to Washington. It was approaching the trade deadline. So Chuck wrote a story talking about players on the Capitals who might be of interest to other teams. It was an analysis story. It was simply, if teams were to come calling about these players, who might fetch the biggest return or who might be the Capitals' best trade asset. Stories we always write in January and February leading into the trade deadline. So Chuck mentions Jason Chimera, you know, now a retired NHL player, played, you know, I think 15 years at least. And I remember one day, shortly after the story was posted, we walk into the dressing room and Jason Chimera makes a beeline for Chuck and just starts screaming at Chuck because people that he knew saw the story, misinterpreted it as saying that Chuck was saying that Jason was going to be traded, and then friends and family sent it to him,
right,
concerned that he was going to be on the move. And Jason lost his mind on Chuck. And I remember him saying, like, I have friends and family, you know, messaging me worried I'm going to get traded. And Chuck, you know, tried his best not to minimize the situation, but just said it was an analysis story, Jason. Right. Like, you know,
we're not breaking news.
Right. So yeah. It was, you know, it was sort of one of those agree to disagree situations. A lot of times players may not be on top of it themselves, but there are people in their inner circles, let's say.
Yes.
Especially their agents, but friends, family, whomever, who are on top of this stuff and will let them know it if something comes up that might be of interest to them.
I do agree that, and I respect you a lot for this, and I probably could have gone into the locker room a little bit more. The problem for a morning show host, of course,
you're on the air,
is I can't be at the game at night and be up at 4 o'clock in the morning.
Yes.
Sorry. It just was never going to happen.
No, you have a reason.
So there was nothing I could do about that. Now, I tried to go as many times as I could for big events or special occasions. I was there a lot more for the playoff runs and the playoff games and stuff, but it's just, there was a time issue there for me personally. But, you know, I'm fine saying, you know what, I wish I would have done a little bit more of that, and that's fine. The question, I every time I was critical of Peter Laviolette, for example, I had a chance to ask him about it face-to-face, even if it was on a phone call, right? I had that chance, so I didn't feel the need to go show my face to him. He could get to me if he needed to. I was available.
Yes.
At any point, if David Poile or Peter Laviolette or anybody else in the Preds organization wanted to reach out and be to contact me or anything I had said that was mildly critical, they knew they could do that. And that's really the most important thing.
Yes.
Is to make yourself available so that, and again, knowing where the lines are to cross, like, I would never cross a personal line. If it became personal with a player or a coach, then I would feel like I did something wrong.
Right.
And I've never crossed a personal line. And I'll, you know, there's a story I've got about Peter Laviolette being super pissed at me, and we'll get to that in a minute. But I don't believe that I crossed a personal line on that particular situation, and I'll explain it later. Have you ever, what's the worst situation where you wrote something critical and that type of thing happened, where somebody either misinterpreted it or it was critical and you had to step into the locker room and say, let's talk about this. Let's, you know, I wrote it. I gave you a chance to comment. You know, now you get a chance to yell at me or something.
I know that
something
this
like
might
that.
Not be the most exciting thing for our listeners, but I have had very few instances of that. And in almost 6 years covering this team, and none where it became a shouting match or, you know, someone was really upset. You know, I remember like my first week or two on the job. This might be the closest I came to it, and it was like my first or second week on the job. And in March,
in March of
2015, when I first arrived in Nashville, the Predators were getting ready to go on a road trip, and right before I arrived in Nashville, James Neal had been injured in a game, you know, about a month prior. And my understanding was that he was listed as day-to-day, as we know in hockey terms. And it had been nearly a month, and he still hadn't come back. And before this, you know, getaway, during this getaway practice day, there was an optional skate, and James Neal participated. And I was told it was the first time he had been on the ice with his teammates since being injured. So I asked to speak with him. The request was declined. I was told that players who are injured are not available to the media.
Right.
And there are certain bylaws in the Professional Hockey Writers Association, you know, guidelines that are made in conjunction with the NHL and Players Association that would dispute that, but whatever.
Also from coach to coach.
Yes.
It's so different. Injuries are very different. Lavi was very specific about not talking about injuries.
Yes. So
Mike Vrabel refuses to talk about injuries.
Yes. You know, with a gleaming personality, Mike Vrabel. anyway, so I wrote the story about how James practiced, but he, you know, declined to speak, you know, to reporters. And then he comes back, and the first time I actually introduced myself to him, because I hadn't yet met him, you know, the first thing he says to me is, so you're the guy who said I wouldn't talk when I was injured? And, like, got really mad at me for saying that he wouldn't talk to me. And we kind of had it. We talked. I mean, it's funny because I think after, like, a minute and a half or 2 minutes, he just didn't give a crap anymore.
Right.
But, like, felt the need to, you know, give me shit, you know, because I tried to do my job.
It's very being in a locker room is incredibly intimidating, especially for a young reporter.
Yeah, I mean, it's...
You got to get your feet underneath
you
a little
bit.
Yeah,
you do. And you have to learn... You have to, like, everybody's, like, it's no different. I always explain it like this. Being in a dressing room is no different than being in an office setting. If you work a regular 9-to-5 job, there are people that you work around that you get along with really well.
Yeah.
You can talk about your personal lives. You can talk about current events. You can talk about whatever. And you get along really well. There are people who you get along with on a professional capacity, meaning, like, if you need someone to answer a question or you need help with something you're working on, they'll help you. And that's sort of the extent of it. Then there are people who you just don't mesh with. I mean, like
who?
So let's break it down.
Like, you've talked about Nick Bonino before.
Well,
so.
Like, for example, like guys like this most recent team, you know, players that I could, you know, shoot the breeze with on anything. Austin Watson. I could talk to Austin Watson about anything, about, you know, what's happening in the league. You know, anything like that. We could just shoot the breeze. Same thing with, you know, Rocco Grimaldi. You know, I could talk to, I mean, I could have a whole conversation with him without bringing up hockey. I wouldn't be even be an interview. Like, I just making my rounds around the dressing room. He's sitting there. We talk. We catch up. Then there are guys like, I'm trying to, like Ryan Ellis. Ryan Ellis is the second one. Like, he's a good interview. Very smart. Not a guy.
Fairly stoic.
Yeah, very stoic.
Yep.
Not a guy that I would, you know, shoot the breeze with. Guy who likes to keep his personal life to himself, and I respect that.
Sure.
So most of the time, our conversations are about hockey, whether it's during an interview or after an interview. Guy, you know, a guy that I know that I can go to if I need a really good quote on something or a good perspective, but not a guy I'm going to say, so how's your wife? How's your baby? You know, not a guy I'm going to do that with. And then there are players who I mean, James Neal, I was a player that I never really meshed with. Nick Bonino, you know, was another, you know, and it's different for, I mean, like Craig Smith, like it's different for everybody. I mean, like it's funny because, you know, you speak of your previous employer, Darren McFarland, who of course we know hosts the Midday Show, him and Craig Smith were as thick as thieves.
Yeah.
I could never get Craig Smith to open up to me like Darren could with Craig. But the funny thing is that those relationships evolve. Like, when I first got here, Colin Wilson to me was in the third tier. Like, we did not mesh at all. I could not talk to him. By the time he left, like around the time he left his last season, him and I got along really, really well. I mean, like, it
also takes time to build trust, because athletes come at it from a perspective of, I've got to be careful of every single thing that I do.
Right.
And I think once you learn that those of us covering the team are doing it mostly because A, we love it.
Have jobs too.
None of us are making a fortune like you guys are. And it's just, you know, I would say this, like, what one of the guys that I really got along with really well, because when I was doing the Smashville Live show, I was able to put on a different hat, which is transition from being super critical when I need to be, complimentary when I need to be, to this personality-driven, get-to-know-the-players-in-a-public-forum show. It was a different show, and it was very easy for me to put on a different hat, to sit there and talk to Ryan Hartman about, you know, his golf game, and, you know, where he moved, how he moved around, and how he became a Chicago Blackhawks fan. And, like, I got along with Ryan Hartman for some reason very well.
Yeah, he was great.
We talked golf, we talked movie. He was telling me about how he just got finished reading Flea's autobiography, the bass player for Red Hot Chili Peppers.
Yes.
And so, like, there was just certain guys that you could do that with. We talked about Matt Irwin. I always really had a good time.
I also would like to stress, just to be clear, that the players who fall into the category of we just didn't mesh are all good people.
Right.
That's not me saying these are horrible guys, right, and you shouldn't be fans of them. It's just we didn't get along. I mean, some of it was, there's really no explanation. I mean, there are people, like we just said, with an office setting. There are just some people you don't vibe with.
Yeah.
And that's okay. And it's nothing personal.
People being athletes that live in a public light, being very careful about what they say, that's not really that big of a deal. People wanting their private lives to stay private, not really that big of a deal. Unfortunately, that sort of butts heads with the idea that you get paid millions of dollars for hundreds of thousands of fans who are obsessed with you. So, like, it just sort of is a natural conflict there between those two different things. And again, the rule for me always was never make it personal. If it's ever personal, then I felt like I did something wrong, and I'm not sure I've ever made anything personal. If you played terribly on the power play last night, that's all I said. It's not because I thought you were a bad guy.
Yeah.
You know, like, I just never made it personal, and I thought that was okay. And as long as that's the case, I don't think the club or the player or the team or the coach has any say to you at all if you don't make it personal. And as long as you do that, I think you're fine.
And I think it's important, you know, I talked about the people who would, you know, it's funny because journalists, just like athletes, journalists are more accessible to readers and fans now more than ever.
Yeah.
You know, before you might have to write a letter to the editor and maybe it would arrive within a week and maybe people would read it and maybe it would go in the paper. But now it's basically available to you. I think Paul Gaharsky talked about this on your Lamestream podcast and you know, several episodes ago. It's like you are carrying around a little device where people can tell you to go fuck yourself.
Basically.
At any time, even if they don't have your cell phone number or anything, like, or all they need is your Twitter handle.
All of our wives are like, keep it in your pocket, dude.
Right.
Like, don't pull it out and look at it.
Oh, that's what she said. That could be misconstrued in so many ways. Sorry, I just couldn't help myself. But anyways, you know, it's funny because, like I said, that people would say to me, fans and readers would say, you know, you think you're such a, you know, keyboard tough or keyboard warrior, whatever they call. You know, my response, I try not to get involved in that, but my response to that is always, I'm in that dressing room every day, or pretty much every day. Sometimes I can't go to practice because I have a doctor's appointment or something. But under normal circumstances, I'm in that dressing room pretty much every day. Those players know who I am.
Yep.
They know, you know, if they need me, if they want to yell at me, I am going to be there. Like, you know, I'm not going to hide from them. I'm not going to just, I wrote this really critical story about player X. I'm just going to happen not to show up for practice the next day.
It's also different in print and radio.
Yeah.
Because when you're just blathering on for 4 hours every day, that stuff disappears pretty quickly. And in print, if you're going to put it down in writing,
right,
it's going to live there forever, and they can go find it after the game or 2 days later or a week later. So it's far different, I think, in print, digitally or otherwise, than it is when you're just talking.
I do think that radio hosts, though, are more accessible because the players might be listening to you in the car as they're driving to and from the
rink.
Some
of them are. We know for a fact who's listening and who's not.
So it might just be lucky, you know, like if you're going to, you know, criticize a player at 9:15, hopefully he gets at the car at 9:25.
Well, but
and he doesn't. But he again, doesn't
like,
hear it.
But even then, like, I would rather them hear it and then say, hey, let's talk. or hey, call me up and reach out to me and say, explain your side of the story. Like I have no problem with, you know, with people name searching and then DMing me. I'll use this as an example. Hugh Freeze is very popular right now because he's going to try to get a job in the Power Five. He has slid up into my DMs before when I've tweeted about him. I don't tag him, but he tweets to me and I'm available. I'll respond to his message or his question, because if you've got a question about something I've said, I view it like you as an obligation to be available. So we'll get to PK Subban and Peter LaViolette in just a second. I want to know morning skate in general as a beat reporter, because I want to get to sort of your experience coming up on the beat. Number one, what do you learn from morning skate, if anything at all, especially under Peter LaViolette, where I don't know if he ever did anything from morning skate that translated into a bigger story in the game. But also, what do you think covering games is going to be like coming up in 2021?
I didn't really learn a lot from watching morning skates. Oftentimes, of course, the most important news is, you know, if an injured player is not on the ice or an injured player is on the ice, you know, which goaltender is starting, just the typical nuts and bolts things that people care about, line combinations, all that stuff.
But like, really, is that if Philip Forsberg gets hurt the night before or the day, 2 games before, and is not on the ice a day later or 2 days later for morning skate, then you can assume that maybe something happened to him that's more serious.
Yes.
But skating with who on a line change on a morning skate doesn't mean anything,
for
right?
For me, the benefit of morning skate, personally, is the access, just because typically, you know, players are more relaxed. You know, some of them are more focused, of course, because it's a game day, but they're more relaxed. Like, there are questions you can ask on a morning skate you can't ask after a game, depending on the result of the game.
Right, right.
You can't save a question saying, well, I hope they win tonight so I can ask this question.
Right.
You know, oftentimes I will go into a morning skate with an idea of what I might be looking for that night, and I might be preemptively asking questions so that if that were to happen, I have comments from them from that morning that I can put in the story that gives it better context. So if something's happening with the goaltending, for example, and I have a feeling that I'm going to write about that after the game, I can talk to Pecorine or UC Saros that morning and have sound from them ready so that I can use it based on whatever they give me after the game. They give everybody after the game. So oftentimes, or I mean, sometimes I work ahead. Like sometimes it's like, okay, well, you know, sometimes I'll pick a player's brain about something. Like, oh, I'm thinking about writing about this. You know, what can you tell me about that? You know, it's very relaxed. It's a very relaxed atmosphere. I mean, I love practice access because that's when their players are at their most relaxed.
Yeah. The NHL feels different than some other sport. I find this with baseball as well. I think baseball coaches, players, managers are far more open and honest with just rambling about their sport. And I think hockey players, to some degree, are like, it's just not the same as the NFL. The NFL is, and college football too, like, which has been my beat for most of my career. Everything is so serious.
Everything is very serious.
So important. Every tiny bit of information is so, it's communist Russia versus the United States, media versus players. I find that the NHL, maybe there's a difference because of language barrier or cultural differences from Europe or Russia or whatever. I don't know what it is. The sport's just not as popular, let's be honest about it, in the United States. I find everyone to be a little bit more relaxed.
What I also find interesting about the NFL versus the NHL, because I haven't covered any NBA games as a working member of media, and maybe one or two baseball games in my life, but I have, you know, done some pinch hitting on the Titans during my time in Nashville during training camp, specifically when I worked for the Tennessean. And some of it is just when you walk into the Titans locker room, first of all, during training camp, there are 70, 80 guys in that dressing room. So there are a ton of guys.
Maybe like 100. Yeah.
Yeah. And the dress in the locker room for the Titans players is their inner sanctum. That's where they get dressed. That's where they take a shower. That's where they hang out. They play video games. They listen to music. They watch TV. They're congregating in the locker room. In a hockey dressing room, that's where they take off their pads and their skates. And then they go to another room.
Because it's smelly in there.
Yeah. They go to another room where they shower and they get dressed. And there's a lounge and there's a gym. Like, and you're not in those areas.
Right.
So, you know, some of that is just like, you're not going to catch players hanging out in the dressing room. And some guys linger. I mean, some player...
Not PK Subban.
I mean, some player, you know, some... It's funny because, you know, there are... Like, you know when the practice is over based on who comes off the ice first. Like, when I first got here, Mike Ribeiro, always, like clockwork, first player off the ice as soon as he possibly could. He was barely in the dressing room or he was on his way out.
Why am
when
I
the
not
media
surprised?
Was about... On their way in, you know, current team, you know, Ryan Johansson is one of the first players off the ice. And sometimes he'll linger. He'll take some time to take off his gear or he'll be talking to another teammate. So he'll still be around. But oftentimes, you know, like Yannick Weber was another player who came off the ice fairly quickly. Not that Yannick Weber was needed all of the time, but like he would always be on his way out of the room when we were allowed in.
Yeah.
Because the rule we talked about, PHWA guidelines, I believe the rule is that 5 minutes after the first player leaves the ice, is there sort of supposed to be a countdown? I think a
cool down period.
Yeah, and then the media is allowed in. So some players take advantage of that by getting in and out very quickly. You know, some players like to stay out on the ice for a very long time, so you might have to wait. And there are some players who like to linger. I mean, Kyle Turris would relace his skates every single morning, and he would sit there and he would take all the laces out and go in there and put them back in, and you could talk to him while he was doing that.
And
talk
about a guy that you could just talk about stuff with.
Yeah.
Like I remember one time all he wanted to talk to me about was the baseball playoffs that were going on. Huge baseball fan, and I think it was like the Yankees in Toronto or something.
A lot of hockey players, as you might expect, are Blue Jays fans.
Yeah, and he just,
first and foremost, Shea Weber.
All he wanted to talk about, yeah, I know Shea's a huge Blue Jays fan. All yes. he wanted to talk about, he would just go on and on about how Minnesota's pitching was or whatever. And he just the nicest guy. We've talked about him. He's just yes. one of the nicest guys, family guy. You know, Dan Hamhuis, just one of the nicest guys in the world. Three daughters, I think. So I bonded with him about being a girl dad or whatever.
Yes.
The guy that I thought was most impressive in terms of answering tough questions face to face. And it was the first interview I ever did when I covered the team, when I first started working on the local affiliate. Pecorine.
Yes.
Is one of the, and I'm telling you, I've done interviews for 20 years with millionaire college football coaches, and you know, I've interviewed Nick Saban before, I've interviewed, you know, you name it. I think I could make the case that the most impressive human being that I've ever interviewed who is willing to answer tough questions with thoughtful, creative answers is Pecorine.
Yes.
And I don't say that because he's the star and all the thing. He is genuinely, he cares about what you are asking him. He cares about his answer. He wants to give you a good answer, even if it's a tough question. I'm not sure I've ever been around a guy face-to-face who would be like, give you a straight answer on a tough question yeah. and not even blink about it.
Yeah, there is a reason why Pekka, for more than a decade, has been beloved by people who cover him because yeah. he does that. I mean, he faces the music when things aren't going well. And you know, he is the emotional leader of that dressing room and has been for a very long time. I mean, it is, people who are fans of Pecorine know it is near impossible, if not completely impossible, to dislike Pecorine. The same thing happens with, I mean, that's an example. We talk about being hard. I mean, in the second half of last season, it was clear, especially after the coaching change, that Pecco was losing his grip on the starting job. And every question I and others asked him about that,
yep.
he handled with class. He handled with dignity. He praised UC Saros. He was always willing to play ball.
It's
that's important. Here's another thing we talk about, human nature, right? Player, I mean, it's just natural. Players who are more willing to give and take with you then receive more benefit of the doubt.
Are you saying you played favorites?
I mean, I think, I'm not sure if played favorites, but like, I think it's natural. Like, if a player that you like, that deals with you respectfully and professionally, has a bad game, you might be willing to give them a little bit more leeway than a player who does not do the same thing. I mean,
man,
it's only,
that's dangerous territory.
I know, but that's not to say that if James Neal had a bad game that I was going to tear him a new a-hole.
See, what you're saying, though, is also what, and I'm probably too neurotic about this, but it's what scared me from getting close to people that I cover. And it's not necessarily friends, to your point earlier. It's It's I didn't want anything to cloud or shade my judgment of how I went on the air the next morning to talk about what I saw. And I did not, just because I thought Marcus Mariota was a brilliant man, or Pecorine was a brilliant man and so classy and dignified and all these things, I did not want it to cloud my judgment as to why I was saying what I was saying on the air. I'm not saying that's what you're doing, but to your point, it's human nature to sort of gravitate towards things that are more comfortable. And I always was scared that if I got into a locker room setting, and frankly, Peter Laviolette was just hard to deal with. He's just a hard guy to be around. And I did not want my judgment of Peter Laviolette to be shaded by the fact that, yeah, he never really warmed up to me. I was around him a bunch of times, and he never really warmed up to me. He just sort of always looked at me as like the guy who did the morning show. And that's his prerogative. But I didn't want that to cloud my judgment of what I saw on the ice. Even though I may have had a weird interaction with the guy, I didn't want it to cloud my judgment. Just like I didn't want it to cloud my judgment in a positive way for Pecorine.
Well, if you recall, his last home start of the regular season, he gave up 8 goals to the Edmonton Oilers. That was the game that Leon Draisaitl scored 4 goals. I wrote a story where the headline was, and I quote, "Pecorine isn't Pecorine anymore." And I basically spent 800 words saying in no uncertain terms that Pecorine was finished. That was not an easy story to write, because I've appreciated everything that Pekka has done for me in my job in the past 5 years, but it did not stop me from writing that story. Perhaps the language was slightly softer, but I still have a job to do. And Pekka understands that. And I don't
That's
know.
What makes him special, though, yes. Is that he's treated you really well. Then you wrote a critical article about him, and he's still willing to treat you well after
right,
that.
Because I think some players, especially the veteran players, know what your job is. And they know, like, you know, we talked about Austin Watson as being a guy who, you know, I could talk about with anything. Austin took interest in, like, what my life was like when I have to get on a plane to get to the next game, and how late do I stay up to write a story, and all of this stuff. Like,
that's not normal.
No, it's not normal. But
in any sport.
But there are players who find you, who are interested in knowing what your process is like. Pecorine and I have never had a conversation about journalism 101, but I think he's been around long enough to know what my job entails, and it entails at times being critical of him. But he knows, because him and I have developed a strong relationship over the past 5 years, that anything I say about him isn't, as you said, personal.
It's going to be fair.
Yes. Yeah. It is impersonal. First and foremost, that's the key word, fair.
Yeah.
I think you can write anything as long as it's fair.
Yeah.
If it's, as long as it's not some sort of hit piece on the player.
Yeah.
You know, the example being, which I'm sure many of our listeners know, the Steve Simmons column about Phil Kessel and the hot dog stand from several years ago. Oh, are you familiar with that?
I forgot all about that.
Yes. Which turned out not to be true, I believe.
Which makes it all that more.
But like, that's the kind, like, I'm not going to write a story about like that. And I think the players that have been in this dressing room since I've been here know that. And I think there's a mutual respect.
Right.
And
I do think if you're an athlete in any sport, the more you understand the journalistic processes, the better you'll be able to use the media to your advantage, frankly. Right. I mean, I think there is also an element of, if you lean into the process a little bit, there's a chance that you might actually be able to use it to your advantage a little bit more. To your point, Pecorine is going to get softer language because he's been a professional and treated you with respect and all these other things. So,
right. There is a benefit to being professional with the media. You don't have to be friendly necessarily, but you can be professional. And there is benefit in that for them. Like, we.
Do you think Peter Laviolette was a professional to you?
I'm choosing my words carefully. Yes, I do believe for the most part that I never felt disrespected by Peter Laviolette. Some of it was just, sometimes I can be a pretty, I don't want to say emotional person, but I'm a heart on my sleeve kind of guy. So if something bothers me, it's easy to tell that something's bothering me.
I'm the same way.
So I don't think I ever felt disrespected, like looked down upon or, you know, anything like that with Peter. You know, our relationship was was strictly professional. Overtures were made over the years to change that, to get a little bit, to get to know him a little bit better. He decided not to partake in those, which is his prerogative. I never blamed him for that, but I could rest easy knowing, well, I tried. Like, I would rather try for us to have a friendlier relationship and fail than never to try.
Yeah. I found that process difficult too. When you see him in a personal setting that's not professional.
In a personal
and you're trying to sort of build a little bit of a relationship. He's, you know, he's very much, I'm the hockey coach. You're, you know, I don't want to say enemy of because you're in the media, but he was just keenly aware that you did something that could cause some sort of conflict at some, you know, I was a morning show radio host talking about his team every morning. Right. And that means all the good things we had to say and all the bad things we had to say.
Right.
So.
And that's how he's always been. You know, for Peter, it was always being protective of his players, like and his game plan, of course. But he was always very protective of his players. He did not want to criticize his players, and he definitely did not want to criticize his individual players. He was always, and you know, some of that, some of the time, you were like, "Come on, just say something mean about somebody once, so I can have a you know, a catchy story to write." But he's always been like that. And again, I grudgingly respected it.
I was like, you can't fault him for that.
No, I grudgingly respected it. It was just, I wish I had more, you know, he gave me more sound that I could use.
I wish I had more quotes, damn it.
You know, like, and this was, you know, last season, I think that we were talking about this before we came on the air. Last season, the first time I asked Peter about his job security was sometime, I think it was like mid-November, like early mid-November. They had just lost a game at home to Vancouver where I think they gave up 4 or 5 power play goals. And I asked him if he was feeling any pressure from above, meaning management, ownership, about this. They had lost like 7 or 8, lost 7 or 8 in a row, or 7 of 8 or something. And, you know, he said, quote unquote, "I haven't felt any," which was the first story I wrote about as relating to, you know, what the future holds for Peter Laviolette. And then they started winning a little bit more, and the storyline died down. But then it was after the Winter Classic where I broached the subject again. And I knew that if I brought up the subject again, that even I knew about this the first time, that that was going to change the way he spoke to me. It was going to change the way he answered my questions if he decided to answer them at all. Now, he never never declined to answer my, like in a scrum format, never said like, "I'm not answering your question," Adam, right, or "next question." But he would be very short on purpose, I feel like.
I mean, Mike Vrabel does that now all the time.
Right. So I understood there was a risk in doing that. But I felt a responsibility as the person who had been around him the most of any reporter in town for the past 5 years, I felt a certain responsibility that if someone is going to write a story about Peter Laviolette possibly being fired, it's up to me.
Yeah.
And I, like I said, it was not something I chose to do lightly. I knew there would be repercussions. I knew when I asked Peter Laviolette about his job security after they lost the Winter Classic that, like, there might not be any coming back from that. But
yeah,
he didn't come back from that.
I shouldn't laugh. That's not...
But that was the last time I saw him as coach of the Predators, because I did not go to the 2 road games following the Winter Classic, and he was fired after the road trip.
It's funny. I've always viewed my role on radio, certainly not as capital J journalist. Like, it's definitely infotainment, you know, to be on the radio. And so I always viewed my role as an interviewer in particular with coaches as a job to sort of loosen them up a bit. Your number one goal as a radio host is to loosen up a guest, to get them feeling comfortable enough to where maybe they answer a question that they weren't planning on answering. That's sort of always the goal, but not in like a gotcha kind of way. It's more of a just, we're just talking here, guys. It's not that big a deal. We're just having a conversation. There may be a few thousand people listening, but it's just a conversation. And I pride myself on my ability to loosen people up in interview settings. It's what I do best in my career. I am not a funny person. There's things that I am not.
Don't sell yourself short.
I am not good at. But what I am good at is I got Mike Vrabel to tell us about the cat he saved during, you know, the hurricane in Houston. And this is Mike Vrabel we're talking about here. I've gotten Nick Saban to chuckle about some stuff. Like, that's what I pride myself on. And I'm not sure I ever got Peter Laviolette to, like, laugh. Like, he would have been the crowning achievement of my career to get Peter Laviolette to laugh about something on the air, because he's so focused on his message and staying on his message and what he needs to say and then getting done and moving on.
Right.
And I could never get him to really loosen up a bit. And that, you know, some of that's just his, how he coached and how he lived and why he's been to three Stanley Cups and has a championship ring. You know, like there's some of that that makes him good at what he does. I do know that right around that same time, when you started asking those questions, is when the NHL went through, and this is sort of my Peter Laviolette story, where I know he was very pissed at me. You know, this is through the grapevine, so it wasn't direct, but this was when the NHL was going through the reckoning that it was going through, where there was a lot of stories about
Mike Babcock got fired,
right?
Bill Peters,
exactly. And so it was about a lot of things. There was some race involved in this. Yes. There was
in Bill Peters' case, it was race,
bullying involved in some of these stories. I think the Franzen story, Johan Franzen story,
yes. And was there was other bullying. Stories about Babcock in Toronto, I believe.
So basically, the NHL is going through this sort of like, there's like this moment where we're sort of taking stock of what we've been doing in the NHL and in especially the lower ranks, mm-hmm. with youth hockey. And of course, there's the Peter Laviolette video of him popping his, you know, his one of his players on the side of the helmet, like
Billy Lano
in 2011, I think. 2011.
It was when he was with the Flyers.
And we went on the air and we talked about how all of these coaches are going through all of these things. And that this video of Peter Laviolette doing this to one of his players in the middle of a game a decade ago doesn't count. Our entire point of talking about this was to make sure Predators fans knew that this stupid social media video was not a part of this greater reckoning that was taking place, right? That there was no reason to lump in Peter Laviolette with these other things that were happening.
And to give some background, the reason why it came back up was Greg Wyshynski of ESPN wrote a column talking to Billy Lano, who was on the receiving end of the, whatever you want to call it, smack to the helmet from Peter Laviolette, where Wyshynski asked Lano about it. Lano sort of said, you know, it didn't really bother me, you know, whatever. And that's how it came back up. Then there was an interview that 104.5 did with Daniel Carcillo, another former player former player who played for Peter with the Philadelphia Flyers, who said some inflammatory things about Peter Laviolette. And yeah, that's how it came back up.
And so I had Wyshynski on the show and did not mention Carcillo at any point during the show. And so I said, you know what? That's not a story I'm going to touch on. I'm not going to cover that because I didn't think there was anything that I felt comfortable going with on one side or the other. But this stupid social media video, this thing that happened in public a decade ago, I thought it was ridiculous that it was being brought up in the larger conversation about bullying and racism and, you know, malpractice, essentially, in so many different situations. And I have it on good authority that Peter Laviolette was furious with me because I said about his statement, I did not believe that it was an accident. I said, I don't believe that it's an accident. I don't know for a fact, but my opinion watching the video is that I didn't think it was an accident, but I also didn't think it was a big deal. And I made that very clear, and I know with relative certainty that Peter Laviolette was very upset with me. And that was right around the time when he was entering a phase of his job that was clearly pressure-filled. I never once did a segment on the air asking that question that you asked him. Should he be fired or not? We never had that conversation.
Well, another thing that
I was at my grandfather's funeral when he got fired. Actually,
I was at the optometrist. Good thing I didn't get dilated. and my wife drove me, which was good. But the point being, another thing that's important is also how you phrase a question. I am very particular about how I phrase questions. I would never ask Peter, why do you deserve to still have this job? Or are you afraid of getting fired?
Right.
I never ask questions like that. I asked him about the pressure he was being put under. Now, through the grapevine, as you said, I also heard that he thought that those questions were unfair. Well, you know, I tend to disagree with that, but it's neither here nor there. Peter has another job. I'm sure he'll do quite well.
Yeah.
But
I'm not worried about Peter. I'll have his ego here.
So it's the phrasing of questions to me is very important. You know, I don't like to put, like, I want to put people on the spot without being like disrespectful or blatant about it. You know, I was never going to say, Peter, why do you think you should still be in this job?
It's a leading question.
Yeah. That's not what I had in mind. you know, like, you know, the last, and I think we can switch gears after this, but I, you know, I explained this, I did a story with my colleague in Washington, Tariq El-Bashir, who covers the Capitals, after the Capitals hired Peter. And he asked, one of the questions he asked me was about his interaction with reporters. And one of the things I explained was that while Peter is doing in his mind the right thing by being ultra protective of his game plan and his players and his thought processes, he was also doing himself a disservice.
Yeah.
And I used the Kyle Turris scratching saga as an example. If Peter would have been more upfront about the reasons he was scratching Kyle Turris, the storyline wouldn't have been in the news cycle for a month.
It would not have ballooned out of control.
You know, he is almost directly responsible for that still being a story by refusing to answer the question. If he would have just, even if he would have just said, here's exactly, or exactly, I say exactly with quotation fingers, what happened, then the story would have been a non-story. It would still have been a story, of course, but it would have been less of a story.
Well, no, it hits. The news cycle happens. Everyone reads it, and then we move on.
Right. But I remember having, I think it was actually just about a year ago, today maybe, I think it was the last Predators game before Thanksgiving. David Poile talked to me and two other reporters during the intermission of a game to basically like clear the air with Kyle Turris. Like, David wouldn't have had to do that if Peter would have been more upfront. But that's his prerogative, and you know, that's why, you know, so far I've been thrilled with John Hines. You know, John is cut from a different cloth. That isn't to say that John is an open book, but John is more willing to explain his ideas and his desires for certain players. It not only helps us do our jobs, it helps him too, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, like, John Hines did not have to work very hard to win me over.
No. It happened to me in one interview. I got 15 minutes with the guy and I was like, oh my gosh, this is amazing.
Right.
You've told us what you're going to do on offense. You've told us what you're going to do on defense. You've told us that if players don't play hard, they're not going to get ice time. And then Johansson didn't get ice time.
Right.
It was pretty straightforward.
Right. I mean, John has been great. I've loved working with John and look forward to continuing to working with John. But like, that's just, I mean, this sort of goes back to the way what we were talking about with players. And it's just the same thing with any walk of life. The way you treat other people goes a long way in how you treat them. Like, so it's just how it goes.
Yep, no question. So do you think you're going to be back in the locker room for 2021 hockey?
I don't think so. I mean, I can't imagine a scenario where we are back in the dressing room until 2021, 2022.
How do you think that affects coverage?
It affects it greatly. And I think we all had to learn, really. Those of us who have access had to learn how to cover a team without the same sort of access. You know, the Predators, to their credit, during the pause in March through July, you know, made players and coaches available on Zoom calls. If you needed something specific, they would organize a phone call. They were really good with that. But some teams weren't so good with that. You know, Zoom calls, you know, it takes away the complete, you know, it completely tears away the personal dynamic, because they can't even see you.
No, it's not human interaction.
Yeah, they're just talking into the void. But you know, it puts a lot of importance on the relationships you have built when you did have access.
Yeah.
It also puts a lot of importance on branching out of the dressing room, you know, talking to people who aren't necessarily on the team. You know, if I want to write a feature story about a guy, don't talk to him. Don't talk to his teammates. Talk to his dad. Talk to his former coach. Talk to his youth coach. You know, someone, you know,
former teammate.
Yeah. Talk to people who you know, you can just say, hey, I, you know, text whenever you want and talk to. And, you know, I think...
Does it force you to be more creative than it sounds like?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. It forces you to be more creative. And it was a challenge, absolutely. But I think, especially at the Athletic, I think we did a really good job, and hopefully we'll have hockey soon so we won't have to, you know, grasp at straws for things to write about. But no, it absolutely forces you to be more creative and to find different ways to tell stories that you would have told under normal circumstances just by going up to a guy in the dressing room.
Well, let's hope the light at the end of the tunnel, a vaccine or something, and all of a sudden maybe by like April, everyone can go back to being normal, maybe. Let's just root for that.
We'll see.
Let's just root for that and see what happens. Anything else, PK Subban stories you want to tell us?
Huh. I don't have too many PK Subban stories. What I find interesting in hindsight I remember when he was traded to Nashville, I was very excited because, as we know, PK is one of the more loquacious players in the NHL, and he was coming from a huge market in Montreal where he was surrounded every day to a smaller market in Nashville where I would be one of the few people around him all the time. And I was like, this is going to be gold. He's going to say so many great things. I'm going to have so many great stories. It did not happen that way. I was largely underwhelmed by PK from a media standpoint during his time in Nashville.
He's very careful.
He's very guarded. He's very polished. Yep. Very polished. I don't know what it is about. I mean, part of me at times thought maybe he thought we were too small time for him in Nashville. You know, we weren't Montreal, we weren't LA, we weren't New York, we weren't Toronto, whatever. But, you know, I enjoyed covering him. He thought he was a funny guy. He was a funny guy. It was fun to have him around. He was one of those guys that you could talk, you know, I talked music with him a lot because he was very much into music. Music that I liked. You know, I'm not a big country guy, so a lot of the, you know, trying to have a conversation with Matt Duchesne about, you know, country music was just like,
pulling teeth.
I did a story about Matt Duchesne last year early in the season where I was fascinated by his pregame routine, because if you're a Predators fan, you might have noticed that, you know, 15 minutes before the players came out for warmups, Matt Duchesne would be sitting on the bench and he would have headphones in and he would be drinking water in a very specific way. And I wrote a story about his whole routine, but I specifically focused on what he does when he's sitting on the bench. And he gave me the playlist he was listening to. Like, he gave me the songs, and I remember making a Spotify playlist and embedding it in the story. So I was like, if you want to listen to what Matt Duchesne is listening to before the game. And I was like, who the hell are these people?
Were they like huge country stars?
Some of them were. I think there was a lot of Hardy is his name. I don't know. There was a lot of Hardy. There was a lot of. I think there was a Luke Combs song in there.
Okay, like, Luke Combs is pretty good.
Like, as I've discussed previously,
it wasn't like cool, like outlaw country, no. Like Margo Price, Jason Isbell, Sturgill Simpson.
It was very pop country.
More bro country.
It was more bro country, and I was just like, I don't know any of this stuff. but
I wouldn't either.
Right. But like PK, I remember it may have been the first year Vegas was in the league. I went during the off night. My parents and my wife came on the trip with me, and we went to see the Michael Jackson Cirque du Soleil show. And I talked to PK about that, cause he was Michael Jackson fan. That was really fun.
You know, the guy that I bonded with over music, Freddie Goudreau.
Huh.
Of all the people, because he's big into like Americana.
Huh. Interesting. So the Quebec native.
I know, he's
very into Americana.
Totally, it totally took me off guard. We did a Smash Roll Live, and afterward we started talking about music, and he was like, "Yeah, I was at the Ryman, you know, going to a Lumineers show. I was watching Mumford and Sons or something like that." And we started talking about Americana, and I was like, "All right, Freddie knows his, you know, off the beaten path Americana music." He was pretty good.
Craig Smith was into metal. I remember one time, like I was just trying to shoot the breeze as we talked about Craig Smith, and I never really formed a bond. But I remember asking him if there were any new albums that were out that he was into, and he was talking about the new Slipknot album. And I was like, I wouldn't have pegged Craig Smith for a Slipknot fan, but that's kind of cool. I'm not a huge Slipknot fan.
Well, it's probably why he and Darren McFarlane and Chase McKay were always such good buddies.
Is Darren McFarlane the big Slipknot?
They just all have terrible taste in music.
Oh, okay. I gotcha. Anyway, so I mean, I the one thing I learned covering PK Subban was, you know, you had to give back. Like, there had to be a give and take. And the example I use is that I remember one time after a practice, we came into the dressing room and there were TV cameras there, and he was almost done getting undressed. And he said, "If you guys need me, I only have like 3 minutes." Before he had to go do whatever the heck PK Subban does. And I remember before that saying, "Would you have more than 3 minutes for me tomorrow?" And he said, "Yeah." And I said, "Okay, then we'll talk tomorrow." And they did something else.
Well, PK Subban's a very busy man. So there you have it. There's a lot. I don't know what else we could have covered. That's about all. That's basically every story we've got from the beat,
yes,
as it were.
I love talking shop. I mean, I love talking about...
Can I just repurpose this and put it on Lamestream Sports?
Sure.
Do that?
I mean, I love talking shop. I love talking about journalism, and I've had the privilege of speaking to a couple of college journalism classes. I love doing
that. Now
you're
just humble bragging.
No, but I know. I mean, there are people I know who do it a lot more than I do. I've only done it like once or twice.
Yep.
But it's fun. Like, it's fun to talk about this kind of stuff because... you know, it's sort of like an inside the actor studio kind of thing. I mean, you get to learn how the sausage is made.
I tend to agree. So we hope you all enjoyed it. Please have a wonderful and amazing Thanksgiving. Adam Vingan, you can follow him on Twitter, at Adam Vingan. You can follow me, at Braden Gall. Thank you all for listening. Have a wonderful holiday. Please stay safe. Wear a mask. Maybe not large groups. Either way, thank you for listening. Rate, review, and subscribe. This is the Gold Standard on the 440 Sports Network.